Welcome to Making the Grade, the podcast that explores what's driving the decline in graduation rates between funding rounds and what it really takes to scale a venture-backed software startup successfully with realistic options to exit. I'm Tom Glasson, CEO at ScaleWise, and each week I'm going to be joined by founders, investors, and some of the best go-to-market leaders in the world to unpack the strategies, the missteps, and the mindset shifts that separate those who graduate from those who don't. Expect real talk, actionable go-to-market insights, and honest stories that will help you scale more wisely and thrive in an increasingly competitive market. Because there is a smarter way to scale, and we're here to uncover it. What if you'd spent over a decade grinding away at a business, only to watch it fail? And then, out of its ashes, you bootstrapped a brand new SaaS company to 25 million ARR without raising a single penny of VC funding. That's exactly what today's guest, Emmerich Ernault, has done with AgoraPulse. Emmerich's story is a masterclass in grit, in resilience, and in navigating not just one pivot, but multiple. And in today's episode, I'm not just joined by Emmerich, but also by Munya Hoto, as we reflect on Emmerich's, at times, turbulent startup journey. He shares tons of advice on the signs to spot when it's time to pivot, the hard truths about bootstrapping a SaaS business in today's market, but why raising money isn't always the answer, and also how founders can avoid becoming the bottleneck to their own business growth. This is a refreshingly honest conversation with one of Europe's most experienced bootstrapped founders, and it's full of takeaways for anyone building a business on their own terms. So let's dive straight in. Emmerich, welcome to Making the Grade. How are you today?
I'm great, Tom Munya. Great to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. So to start us off, Emmerich, maybe you can just give us a quick whistle-stop tour of your career to date and take us on the journey that brought you to where you are today. That would be amazing.
Started as a business lawyer doing M&A for an American law firm. Stopped that in 2000. Started my first company with my co-founder at the time, who is still my co-founder today. We started a SaaS company already. It was not called SaaS. It was called something else, but it was already software as a service and already social media, which was not called social media. It was called communities. We did that for a year, burned all our savings, went back to my law firm, begged for them to take me back. They did. I was happy. Worked for there until 2004 and then quit again, go back to being an entrepreneur. And kept doing the SaaS company that was not making money, but we both really, really believed that it would one day, which was a bit crazy. Did that until 2011. And, you know, going short, there were so many different pivots and tries, but it didn't really work. That first business failed. Let's put it this way. We started AgoraPulse, a current business, on the dead body of the first business, and using the AR, thank you SaaS business model. There is little momentum behind your revenue, so you can build a new business out of the previous one. And we started as a product that was doing contests and promotions on Facebook only, and we pivoted several times to do social media on all social networks, which took a lot of time because we were bootstrapped. Still, as of today, we never raised funds to fuel the business. And we moved from zero to 100K of monthly recurring revenue between end of 2011 and end of 2015. So it took 4 years and we broke even at that point. And we're currently at 25 million annual recurring revenue. So yeah, it's been a journey.
Wow, it certainly has.
Emmerich, it's good to see you again. I have memories of our first hangout, which goes back a long time now, it's pre-COVID. Sharing a beer together on the sunny streets of Paris and you actually telling me why you called the business AgoraPulse. So maybe let's start there. And then, you know, tell us about the origin story of this particular business and how it's evolved into the business it is today.
Yeah, so the original story of the business is that, first of all, we didn't really have a grand vision for it, but we were wanting to survive because as you just heard, for 10 years, we were in survival mode. We basically made very little money. It was really, really hard. So when we started AgoraPulse, the only thing I had in the back of my mind is I want to have a sustainable business that can sustain my own life, you know, my own rent and my own food on the table. So contests and promotions was all the rage in 2010 and 2011. And we said, okay, we're going to productize this. Instead of doing an agency type of work, we're going to build contests and promotions for you, which everybody was doing in 2010, 2011. We turned that into a platform that people could self-serve and create their own their own contests and promotions on Facebook for $49 a month instead of paying them, you know, $8,000 a piece. But we already quickly saw the potential of social media to be the new CRM. That's how we positioned ourselves at the time. We saw that businesses could actually build relationship with their audiences and qualify them and get their email and get all sorts of information through the contests and promotions and their interactions on social media. And by bridging the gap between the two, we were basically measuring what the people around those brands, I mean, the prospect, the customers, the people who were interested in them, were doing. And so Agora, which is where the people gather in ancient Greek, became a good, you know, a good first segment for the name. And Pulse, which is, here's us giving you the pulse of the people and where the people gather, which is on social media. So that's where the name came from.
Well, one of the things we often talk about on this podcast, Emmerich, is how resilience and I suppose adaptability are defining traits of successful founders. And I know from my own experience how I suppose painful but also powerful pivots can be. And I get a sense that you've kind of navigated a few of those pivots, both before you started AgoraPulse, because you mentioned it earlier, but also at AgoraPulse as well. You talked about, you know, how the business has probably evolved over the last 10, 15 years. Maybe you can just share the lessons you learned through those pivots and maybe any advice you have for people listening and going through a similar journey at the moment. Because I know we have lots of founders that are contemplating pivots, have been through pivots, and would love to hear the big lessons that you've learned along the way.
Yeah, well, first of all, you need to identify the signs that you need to pivot. And the signs are quite easy to read, but quite hard to accept. When I say easy to read, what I'm going to say is very basic. And you're going to say, yeah, of course, but if you're not growing, you need to pivot. If you're not making profit, you need to pivot. If your business is not giving you the success and the growth and making your customers happy and wanting more, then that means you need to pivot. So if you are not getting the success a normal business should have, which is being profitable and growing, then you need to make a change in how you go to market and who you sell to and what you sell to them. That's as simple as that. And I'm saying it's simple, but not easy to hear, because a lot of time, and I've been through that myself in the early days of my career as an entrepreneur, you look at your business and it's not working and you think grinding and grinding and doing more of what you're already doing is eventually going to make something happen, which is never true. So basically, if you're struggling, if it's not working and you have a product and you have a market and you're marketing to, you know, a set of prospects and the success is not there, that means you need to make a drastic change to either what you sell or who you sell it to and how you sell it and how you go to market, how you distribute that. So don't fool yourself. If it's not working, you need to change something. And sometimes you need to change everything. So that's the first thing. And the second thing I would say, it's not really a piece of advice, it's a piece of warning, is in 2025, in 20 years ago, you probably had to pivot, you know, once every 2 years. If you had an original thing that was working, once every 2 or 3 years, you had to think about a pivot you had to make, small or medium. In 2025, you have to pivot every 6 months. I mean, the speed at which everything goes with AI and everything these days, if you are not in constantly rethinking who you're going after, with what and through what channels, you're going to die very much quicker than you could have died 20 years ago. When I look at our first business, we made three major pivots. It didn't work, but every time it had some impact, but not enough of an impact. With AgoraPulse, in 14 years, we've made four big pivots. We're currently doing another one, but I'm already looking at what is the next one, you know, because there's one down the line in the next 2 to 3 years. We've all the changes with AI, there are pivots we have to make or we should make if we want to grow faster or better.
Wow. And it sounds like from what I'm hearing, Emmerich, that this need to kind of pivot more frequently in the current macroeconomic environment is super important. But how do you then balance, you know, the kind of internal potential whiplash that you can create and the disruption, you know, versus, you know, just knowing that you need to change something and that something could be quite fundamental, as you say, like the product or like the target industry. Is there any advice for founders around how to navigate that pivot internally so that teams don't get that whiplash effect?
Yeah, well, that's a tough one. First of all, you need to be aware the larger you are, the harder it will be to make that internal change. change management is a thing. It's not only in business books, it's in real life, and it's really difficult to do. If you're a very small team of 20 people in the same room, then it's going to be quick and easy, sort of. If you're a team of 300 spread across the world in different languages and countries and stuff, it's going to be a little harder. If you're a company of 1,000, it's going to be really, really hard. If you are in countries where you can do layoffs and terminate people with ease, it's going to be easier. If you're in countries where you cannot do that, such as Italy, Germany, France, like, it's going to be really, really hard. Because there are times where you have to change an entire team, or you have to change a leadership, and then they will change a lot of their teams. Because the thing you're going to and you're moving away from are completely different things that your people are not going to be able to comprehend or implement. And this may sound harsh, but if the survival of the whole business and the whole team is dependent on that, then obviously it's important that as a leader, you do it and you go hard with it. The way you do that with a team is you communicate often and again and again and again, and you use different channels and you use different messages and you use different assets to do that communication, to explain why you're doing it. You're not just doing it because you felt it was cool to sell to the mid-market instead of to the SMBs. You're doing it because SMBs are going down and retention is horrible and growth is stalled and mid-market is paying more for your product and has retention numbers that are bad. So you take all of that information and you give it to them so they understand why you're making the move. And one thing I've read in a book that I love is we're all chief repeating officers as leaders. You have to repeat the message you're trying to get across, which is a really hard thing to do, because once you've said it once, you feel, I've said it already. Why do I have to say it again? Well, you have to say it again because out of your 200 people, only 60 have heard it and 25 remember it. and 12 actually understood what it means. So that's why the repetition has to be done again and again and again. And that's probably the biggest piece of advice that I can share, because I know for myself, I have not repeated myself enough in the early days. Like, and then still today, I can probably do more.
I think that's really, really good advice, that over-communication, which, as you say, is easier said than done, but so important when you're trying to bring a team along with you on a journey of pivots like this. I'd love to just quickly touch on, you talked about the fact that you bootstrapped AgoraPulse. And, you know, in a world where raising millions of dollars has almost become a badge of honor, I think it's incredibly refreshing and actually important to spotlight stories like yours. Can you maybe share some insights on why you decided against the VC route?
Well, first of all, it's a little bit more complex than that. In the early days, we wanted to raise money because growing a business without external capital is extremely hard. And so we tried and we were rejected again and again and again. So we could never raise money in the early days when we needed it the most, because basically I was paying myself minimum wage for 2 years in a row and my wife was paying for everything and I was not comfortable. Then we started to break even and have some level of success. And then people wanted to invest in us. And at that point, we said no. At that point, we said, oh, no, we're profitable and we're growing. Why would we take your money? And the one thing I understood at the time is that it's great to raise money. It's not bad. It's actually a good thing if, and that's an important if you know exactly what you're going to do with the money and you have very, very high certainty because of your experience and expertise about the outcome that money is going to bring. If you raise money to raise money, what you're going to do is add money in your bank account and lose a portion of your company, and that's it. And waste a lot of it. And that I've seen again and again and again with founders who have raised money without a clear idea of what to do with the money. If your clear idea of what to do with the money is, oh, we're gonna hire a bunch of people and we're gonna buy a bunch of ads, forget it. That's not a good way to use money. The good way to use money is on a clear go-to-market that you know already works, that you've already proven, and where you can add more fuel to get more outcomes. So a lot of founders do not know that, and they think that I'm going to hire more developers and I'm going to pay Google Ads. That is a recipe for disaster. If you know what to do with the money because you've already nailed a go-to-market that works really well and with more fuel, it can go faster, then it's a good idea to raise money. If you don't, i.e. you're struggling to grow, you're struggling to be profitable, you're struggling for product market fit, raising money is just going to add more pain to your life because now you have people you report to and you will probably still be struggling after, and it's not going to make your life easier or any more fun. So that's the thing I use now. All our go-to-markets and the way we've grown was never really money-fueled, meaning that it just took time, and we just had to invest the right amount of time and the right amount of work in the right areas, and more money would not really have changed that. So as a matter of fact, because we've been profitable since 2015, we've just added cash in the bank, and our bank account keeps growing, and I don't spend it on growth because I've done it once in 2022. I'm going to be honest here. I've done it once in 2022. I've wasted 2 million euros. And I'm not doing that again, meaning that the problem when you start pouring money at things that you're not really comfortable about, the outcome they're going to bring, you waste the money. And I've heard founders tell me so often that they've raised 50 million and they wasted more than half of it because they didn't know where to spend it. And they just spend it in the easy ways, the Google ads and the whatever, the thing that is easy to spend money on. Or they hired a bunch of analyst, influencer, relationship manager, yada, yada, yada. And those people did nothing and brought no value. And you end up, you know, it goes quite fast to spend 20 million bucks if you're not careful. And basically, the more money you have, the bigger your mistakes. If you have a lot of money, add a lot of zeros to the mistakes you're going to make. That's as simple as that.
You mentioned that, you know, we're now going to have to pivot more frequently than we ever have in the past. And what people really go after when they go to try to raise money is somebody who's going to understand the pivot because they've seen it happen 3 or 4 times in other businesses. And you're ready for it, but you're seeing it for the first time. Whereas you have this belief that they've seen it 10 or 12 times or 5 or 6 times. So they're going to help you and handhold you through that treachery of pivoting in a good way. And is that in and of itself a really justifiable reason to say, okay, I know the money is going to make me dirty. It's going to mean I'm going to have a lot more pressure and more accountability. But these guys have turned it around 3 or 4 businesses successfully through the, you know, proliferation of AI or through going to cloud native, whatever it is. And I've never done it, but they seem to have this really great playbook on this. And I need that knowledge and understanding. How have you navigated that? How have you shaped your board, your advisory team around being able to have that expertise that helps you to think through those things?
I think when you consider taking money from a VC, think that 95% of what you're going to get is just the money. Maybe 5% will be more than the money, but maybe 5%. If you get more than the money, it's going to be 5%. But it's probably not going to be that. And if you get more than the money, it's not going to be much. And I think it's really important to understand that. Yeah, they've seen a lot of things, but they've seen it from a distance. They've seen it from, it's as if you're on the beach, you're on a high chair, and there's someone droning a mile away. I see someone droning. I can tell you how it looks like. Well, you were not underwater seeing what was happening, why they were droning. Was it, you know, kind of, they got hit by something, or they got a heart attack, or they're not with a person asked talking to them, what's going on? You're droning now. Tell me what's happening. Why do you drone? What did start that? What did you do 10 minutes ago? What led to that? So every time a VC told me, oh, that company did this and that company did that and that company was successful because of X, Y, and Z, when I went and had a chance to talk to such company, they every single time told me, oh, no, that's not that. No, they didn't understand. This is what happened. This is how we did it. This is the problem we had. This is how we solved it. And I mean, I have investors and they're great. They're lovely. I love them. But they come to a board 4 times a year for 2 hours and they see a spreadsheet report once a month. That's the vision they have of my business. They don't spend time in the trenches with me 8 hours a day. So the way they understand my business is very surface level. And it's also based on the report I make to them and my team make to them. We cannot tell them everything because they have dozens of businesses. They would die doing everything we do and learning about everything we learn. So their understanding is surface level. And many times it's wrong. It's not wrong in the sense that it's a lie or it's bad or it's just too surface. It's so surface level that it's not deep enough to be real and to be exactly what I would tell another entrepreneur who's going through. Okay, let's say I'm going through the pivot of SMB to mid-market. The things I'm going to tell you are going to take 2 or 3 hours, bare minimum, if we go through marketing and sales and product and compliance and ISO and SOC 2 and all the things. What I told my investors is 10% of that at best, because I don't have time to share more than that, and they don't have time to learn more than that from me. So back to what you said, yes, they've gone through a lot. Yes, they've seen a lot. Yes, they can give you hints to send you directions, but that's all there is to that. They will not give you the recipe. They will not tell you how it's done. They will not help you do it day to day, which is all that matters. Execution is what matters in pivoting, in changing. They don't know how to execute because guess what? They've never executed. Most of them. Or they have 20 years ago in a different state of the market, in a different company, in a different product. I advise company I invested in, and some of them are B2B SaaS, or they're in my exact thing, but they are a different product, selling to a different persona with a different value prop. My advice is just worth my advice. Like, and I keep telling them, you know, this is my advice. This is what I would do if I were you. But again, you're the one owning the business. There's so much I don't know. So for them, it's even worse because I'm an entrepreneur doing the work in investing in B2B SaaS companies. So I probably know more things that are aligned with what they need to know and what they need to do. But a VC who's a financial guy or girl who's never run a business. So, I mean, I don't blame them. How could they know? It's not possible.
Gosh, Emmerich, you make so many important points there. And the point around them not knowing the recipe and not being able to tell you what to do is one part of it. But even worse than that, telling you what to do, but without, as you say, the context, the informed decisions, the understanding of the business relative to, you know, how it compares to others. And I've personally been in businesses where I've been the CRO, and the CEO has been under huge pressure from the VCs to do a thing in a certain way or to approach the US in a certain way based on an experience that they had, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago in a completely different business. And then actually what ends up happening is, you know, the CEO is under the pressure to, I mean, in this case, it was expanding into the US just way too early and with, you know, putting way too much spend behind it and then having to retrench 9 months later, having spent $2 million, you know, so like the best case is they don't tell you what to do and they don't give you the recipe. But the worst case is actually much worse than that, which is they give you ill-informed advice that lacks the context. And I have
plenty of examples exactly like this one. VCs telling you should do that. They do that. It's a disaster. I have plenty of examples. Oh, you need to hire that kind of VP of sales using that kind of headhunting firms. They did all of that and it failed. So absolutely.
I just want to maybe stick with the theme of international expansion for a moment, because it is often seen as a milestone of success, but you know it can easily become a really costly distraction if not executed well. And you know, from our own work with hundreds of scale-ups at ScaleWise, we just know how nuanced and unpredictable that expansion effort can be. I know you have first-hand experience in expanding internationally, which is something many founders listening will aspire to do, perhaps have tried and failed at. What are your top pieces of advice for global expansion?
Yeah, so here again, my advice is just worth my advice, or what is, you know, what I've gone through and what I've built. So it will not be exactly applicable to everyone the same way. And what you need to take with a grain of salt is that when we started Agorapulse, we were a product-led business. We were totally PLG. So when you're PLG, going international is that's a totally different cost and different flavor than when you're sales-led and enterprise. Sales-led and enterprise, then you want to go international. That means you need salespeople, CS people, BDRs in every location for time zone purposes and culture alignment purposes, also language. So like it's much more complex and difficult. So for PLG, it's much easier because you can go, yeah, let's go Mexico, and you do some ads and you do some SEO and you do some Spanish content and you do some Spanish webinars. So like it's easier to do at a lower cost. If you're enterprise or targeting larger accounts, it's much more complex and much more expensive. So that's first the thing to keep in mind. The one thing I think you need to do is, and that especially applies to non-native English speaking businesses, everything has to be in English. English has to be the working language. If you're French, if you're Spanish, if you're Italian, if you're Israeli, whatever, English has to be the working language so that your company can target English speaking countries, which makes for, I don't know, 65% 70% of the world's SaaS market, right? So that's the one thing. As a French company, that's what we've done. And I think that was a lifesaver. The number one thing on the list of why we succeeded internationally. So that's the first thing. And it's not insignificant, because that means all the documentation you produce has to be in English, even though it's not your native language. All the meetings that you conduct have to be summarized, or the notes you take, or, you know, right now my exec team is French speaking only, which is the first time in 14 years. It used to be, there was always an English speaking person in my team up until February of this year. And everything we did had to be in English. Now it's French. But even though my team speaks French, I need and I expect every documentation that comes out, every report, every notes from our meetings to remain in English. So we can, if I have to move someone, English speaking, non-French speaking person in the exec team in 6 months, seamless, because everything is already in English, or our habits are already done in English. So that's really habit number one in it. But if you pick a country where you say, I'm going to apply all my work, all my dollars, you know, ad dollar, all my content dollar, all my everything dollar, aim for the largest country you can reasonably aim for. And if it's the US, then aim for the US. Start there. Don't start in the UK. Don't start in Ireland. Don't start in France. Target the US and have the US be your main market. That's what we did. And that's why for a French company, the US market is 40% of our business today. With a bootstrap company, that's quite unusual. And that is because between 2012 and 2016, all I've done marketing-wise, you know, events and webinars and content and blogs and yada and yada, that I was almost doing myself for the first two, three years, was targeting American influencers, was written in American English language, all the events were American. I was always focusing my attention to the American market. And so if you're back to, you can't raise money or you don't raise money, you have limited resources and bandwidth, then focus on the largest country you can reasonably target. And I say reasonably target, that's an important caveat here. Try to think this way: what is the largest country I can reasonably target given my bandwidth and abilities as of today, and do the best with what you have?
Emmerich, I mean, yes, 100%. I just want to say at this point, because I think it's lost in the nuance of everything that you're saying, that I think it's incredible that you got to 25 million ARR bootstrapping this business, and, you know, well done to you. So let's not say that, because that's hard and nearly impossible, I think, in this environment. But, you know, along the way, you've paid some painful tax on lessons learned, just on, even on the GTM side. International expansion is one place where you have a lot of experience, and you know, personally involved yourself in those campaigns. But when you start to think about growth today, and if you knew then what you know now, you might have made different choices. What do you think about the metrics that you should be tracking, and what are the vanity ones for you now, and what are the key ones that mean that you're going to have proper execution that drives GTM efficiency and growth going forward? And I know you've got a tale to tell around this, but what's your feeling at this point when you think about, you know, I want this thing to grow. I want it to be to grow in a data-driven way. I've paid a lot of school fees over the years. Where's your head at when you start to think about how to measure and manage growth and success going forward?
First of all, measuring things is a topic in itself. We didn't have any data person when we were a team of 15, because you cannot afford having a data person. So what we could measure was everything based on what was off the shelf, like Google Analytics 4 or SaaS metric. We're using FinCom now, NR, growth retention, ACV, like all those SaaS metrics. We use something off the shelf as well, ChargeB for all the revenue stuff. So we didn't have anything. So you're limited to what you can do. And it's a challenge. I'm not going to lie. It's only when I was able to hire a data person and a second and a third. And at some point we had up to five data person in our data team, that we started to have the reports that we can actually look into that are granular enough. We have all the right filters by country, by industry, by company size, by revenue for us, MR size. Like, we started to create reports that were giving us so much insights that we started to understand what was working and not working. So the first thing I would say is, like, be mindful of where we are in your journey and be okay with not being able to get, you hear that, you know, you have to be data driven and you have to measure everything. Or if you're a team of 15, you're not going to be able to be data driven as much as when you're a team of 200 with a data team of 5. It's just a matter of fact. So be aware of that and don't beat yourself up. If you're a team of 15, you'll have what you can have. And that's already pretty good. The metrics, the god of the metrics in SaaS is NRR, net revenue retention. And I wish I had paid attention to that earlier. And I wish I had, you know, worked a little bit faster in pivoting to places and industries and countries and revenue, you know, that had a higher retention and pivoted in ways that increased the potential to better NRR. So that's the first thing. Don't fool yourself about what it means to have 4% monthly net revenue churn. 4% monthly net revenue churn is horrendous at 20 million of revenue. It's okay and manageable at 2 or 3. So that if you have good acquisition. So be mindful. I have found products online where you can project where you are in terms of revenue. And if you keep adding that many euros or dollars or pounds every month, and you keep having an X percent net revenue churn, basically the curve shows you when you stop growing or when you never end growing and accelerate if you have positive NR or negative net MR churn. And though you need to be aware of those things. There's so much we can say about what to measure and what matters. But this one specific metric, if you really understand really, really well and explain it to your team. When I started to explain to my team, given what growth we have today, what net MR churn we have today and how much revenue we're adding, this is when we stopped growing. They were all like deers in a headlight. Oh, really? I didn't have a clue because we were still growing 40%, 50% a year. Yeah, but that's going to end. And given our history of metrics, in 4 years, we're stalling. And that people did not understand. I did not understand, my bad, my fault, but people in my team certainly did not understand until I showed them the curve and the graphs and the actual results. So that's my piece of advice, number one. Piece of advice number two, and that's because we're in 2025 and AI is everywhere. You absolutely have to have a very, very clean and as clean as possible data lake, or you know, whatever you call that, where your data is stored. So the sooner you can have someone help you have a clean database where everything is understood, when every column title is clear and the definition is agreed on by everyone in the team, and it makes sense, and it's aligned with how you define this metrics and that metric. When the data flowing in from HubSpot and Salesforce is consistent and it's not duplication, or like have a clean data infrastructure. Really invest in a clean data infrastructure, because if your data sucks, then what AI will tell you about your data will suck as well. And make sure of that first. And as you make that, have an MCP, build an MCP to your data. And plug, we use Claude today. You could use anything, but Claude is apparently still up today the best for data. Plug Claude to that MCP and start querying your data going very deep. And that is, I mean, we've started to do that 2 months ago. So maybe we're late to the game. I don't know. But 2 months ago, we started playing with that. And oh my God, this is incredible. Like the kind of insights you get. What a data analyst would give you in 2 weeks of work in 27 seconds and 17 cents is absolutely outrageous, the amount of insights that you're able to gather through that in no time. So that would be my second piece of advice that you can slice into two, like have an amazing, clean and clear data infrastructure so that AI can understand it and make no mistake and don't confuse one thing with another. And then have an MCP build on your data lake by your CTO and plug Claude to it. It's crazy game changing for your data analysis and how you understand and how you see the small signs inside your data that are telling you your next pivot should be this, because there's one segment of your customer who's doing amazingly well and this is this segment. And it would have been really, really hard to guess or impossible to guess. And for a data analyst, it would have taken like a week of, you know, research and queries to understand where AI is going to tell you in less than 5 minutes.
Oh, Emmerich, great insights. And you're completely right. I'd talk about this for a lot longer. And, you know, we've covered some great ground already, but I'm conscious of time. So kind of, I suppose, wrapping up the show, if you could change one thing about the startup ecosystem, what would it be and why?
I believe that no startup founder is the right person to take his or her company to the next step. And all of us are startup founders. We have to be constantly upgrading ourselves, and we have to be constantly on the lookout for learning the next thing that we need to master and we need to learn. So I think the one thing I would change, because I'm still seeing today founders who are not investing in themselves enough, I would make every founder always on learning mode, like always listening to podcasts like yours or others, always trying to learn the next thing, always trying to understand the jobs of their teams. If you need to hire a new CMO, like listen to marketing podcasts for 6 months before you hire your next CMO, so you understand what you need, what you should hold them accountable for and not, and like what the things they are responsible of and the things they are not. Like more questioning yourself, more challenging yourself, more realizing that you're not enough and you have to become enough. Otherwise, your business is never going to grow to where it can grow. And better understanding of the importance of self, you know, self-learning, self-teaching. And I think we are our own limitations. Our investors are not, money is not, market. The market is going to be the market, you know, money is going to be up and down, markets are going to be up and down, but we are the ceiling of our businesses. So if we don't grow, our businesses won't grow either. So that's the one thing I would change. I would push founders to be more aware of that and to be more aggressive on getting better and learning.
Love that, Emmerich.
Yeah, no, Emmerich, that's brilliant. And you know, I guess on my part, and I think Tom would share this sentiment, I'm really excited about what happens next. You've just done a pivot. You've got some new talent on the team. You're already flying. What you're going to do in the mid-market and the enterprise is anybody's guess, but it's a super exciting thing to watch unfold. But amazing work, genuinely, and I hope you're really proud of yourself and the team for where you guys have got to.
Thank you for the kind words. I appreciate. Now, don't forget that everything that's exciting is also incredibly scary.
Of course, always.
If it was hard, everyone would do it. Well, I just want to wrap up and say, Emmerich, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on Making the Grade. Thank you so much for sharing your journey, your honesty, and of course, your insights with our audience. I actually think you're a real inspiration for bootstrap founders and frankly, anyone building a company on their own terms. I think you've shown that you don't need a pile of venture capital to create a meaningful global SaaS business. And in doing so, I hope that you've given permission to a whole generation of founders to define success differently, I suppose, on their own terms. So we really appreciate you being so open with your story. I know our listeners will take away not just tactical lessons, but also a huge amount of encouragement and belief that there is another way. So thank you again for coming on Making the Grade, Emmerich.
You're welcome, Tom.
Thank you so much for listening to Making the Grade. We really hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you have any questions following this episode, or you'd like to recommend a guest perhaps for our next season, please let us know at podcast@scalewise.com. And if you did enjoy today's episode, please do consider leaving us a review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We'd really appreciate that. As this is a brand new show, reviews really help us spread the word and reach new listeners. Plus, we'd also love to hear what you're enjoying about our show. Thank you so much for your support, and see you soon for another episode of Making the Grade.